Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning, everybody. This is Danny Nazarani, your host for this hour of Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. It is Tuesday, September 8th, and it is a lot livelier up here at Simon Fraser University. Believe it is the welcome day, so welcome to all first years and people returning here for another year of academics or whatever you may be doing here at SFU. Make sure you come check out the station at some point. But before we get started with today's episode, I just want to acknowledge that this program, as well as all of our programs, are broadcasted on the unceded and ancestral lands of the Hokomilam and Squamish speaking peoples who have been here on these lands since time immemorial. Now, before we get into the talk in the news of this hour, let's play a local track. This is from a band that is going to be performing at the Music Waste fundraiser happening at Green Auto on September 20th. Music Waste is a very, very long-running independent music and culture festival that has been going on since at least, I think, for 32 years at this point, and currently they are doing a fundraiser event so that they can hopefully continue doing those festivals. Again, it's on September 20th, and this band that is going to be performing goes by the name of Bloom Effect. This is their track, Hide.
I'll be the one you feel, holding on if you are.
Reporting from Vancouver, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On September 1st, outside of Vancouver City Hall, the organization named Women Transforming Cities launched the Our City Hall campaign. Women Transforming Cities is a grassroots feminist charity that aims to radically shift social, economic, and political power to equity-deserving groups. One of the ways they aim to do this is through the Our City Hall campaign. The result of over a year of community surveys, outreach, and engagement, identifying the major policy asks that people have for the next mayor and council after October's municipal election. CJSF went down to City Hall, where we spoke with Clara Prager, the manager of civic engagement and advocacy for Women Transforming Cities. During our conversation, we learned about the specific policy asks the campaign is advocating for, how the engagement and opinions received this election cycle differed from previous years, and where the campaign will be going next. Take a listen.
Yeah, today Women Transforming Cities is launching the Our City Hall Pledge, which is our six policy priorities for mayor and council candidates in this upcoming election. So for the past several months, we've been engaging with community and listening to residents and organizations to understand their needs. We translate what we heard into concrete policy asks that the next mayor and council could implement, and we ask them to commit to taking action on these priorities if elected, and then after the election we hold them accountable to those promises and ask them to follow through. So we spent 12 months engaging with residents. We heard from thousands of people, 600 survey responses, 30 workshops with community partners with over 500 participants, tabling at 22 events and hearing from thousands of people at these events. And what we heard was, and our policy asks really are our vision for a more affordable city, a more connected city, and a healthier city. Things like more co-op and social housing, more reliable transit, more affordable transit, community spaces where people can come together and have social connection, access services they need, things like longer library hours, food security, and public washrooms and gender safety.
Mm-hmm. This is something that you had done also for like the previous municipal election. How do the priorities and policy pledges that you put forward differ when compared to 4 years ago?
Yeah, good question. This is actually the fourth time that we've run this campaign. We've run the Our City Hall campaign in every election since 2014. But this time we've changed the name to, it used to be called the Hot Pink Paper Campaign, and now it's called the Our City Hall Campaign. And some of the things that we've noticed have changed since the 2022 iteration of this campaign are food security was, we heard about that in the last iteration, but now it's undeniably a really big priority for so many demographics, and that's one of our calls to action for mayor and council candidates. And then community spaces wasn't something we heard about as much in 2022. Could have been because we were right in the midst of the pandemic. But right now, people are really craving places where they can gather with family and friends, where they can access childcare, access mental health supports. So we're asking the city to provide real estate property that they own already. They actually own thousands of property across the city to ensure that these services are more accessible. So those are some of the things that are different. Some of the things that we've noticed are the same. Housing continues to be the number one priority. That has not changed. Transportation and public washrooms were also asks in our last campaign. Those are carried forward in this campaign as demands for City Council to take action on because we just haven't seen enough progress on those issues in the last 4 years.
Are there any council candidates so far that have put their support behind this initiative?
A lot of council candidates and mayoral candidates were here today, which we really appreciate. And we have sent the pledge to all parties. And we hope that all candidates for mayor and council will respond and enthusiastically say yes to this vision for a more affordable, a safer, and a more connected city.
Yeah, I mean, I'd imagine that even after the election, like the work doesn't stop there. Women Transforming Cities, is there more
I guess, are there plans for the future post-election to just keep advocating for these kind of things?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We really emphasize that this is a four-year campaign, that, you know, when we're engaging with communities, we're not just asking them what they need, but we're also working to build capacity and build power so that after the election, we can organize together and work to hold our elected leaders accountable to follow through on these asks. You know, it's not enough to just pay lip service during the election. We actually need action, even when it's not politically convenient. So we do a lot of work to equip people to speak to city council, to understand what their local government can do for them, and to take action so that we can continue to push for these six policies for years to come.
I think those are all the questions I had to ask, but if there's anything else that we didn't touch on that you think is worth mentioning, please do.
Sure. We'll be sharing the results of the pledge at our City Hall Forum, which is our council candidates debate, on September 16th. So we've invited all major parties to participate in that, and we hope we're almost sold out. So if you do want to attend our in-person part of that, do register soon. It's a free event, and you can find more information on our website, womentransformingcities.org.
Once again, that was Clara Prager, the Manager of Civic Engagement and Advocacy for Women Transforming Cities, speaking at the Our City Hall campaign launch, where the organization detailed their six major policy asks for council and mayoral candidates in the upcoming Vancouver municipal election. This has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. We are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Municipal elections are coming up quite soon here all throughout BC, including in our neighboring local municipalities such as Burnaby, New Westminster, and Vancouver. That was a piece centered on Vancouver's municipal election, and it seems like there is another pretty breaking update on the election that has come out just a few minutes ago, per Justin McElroy of the CBC, saying that William Azaroff is now officially out of the race for the mayor of Vancouver. He's announced the end of his one city candidacy, most likely in order to rally behind Pete Fry, who had apparently been at the kind of front of the polls when it came to the sort of progressive candidate that people wanted to rally behind against Ken Sim, who was sort of the front runner at the moment for mayor. And we will see where that goes. At the moment, I think in terms of progressive candidates, it does seem like Pete Fry is the one who is going to be the person people will be coalescing around. So when there are further updates, we will let you know. But as of just a few minutes ago, William Azaroff is now out of the race for Vancouver City Council and for the mayor of Vancouver. Now, moving on, we have another piece. This one is coming out of New Westminster, BC, about a rally that took place last week outside of the TransLink office regarding concerns that workers had over working conditions, specifically SkyTrain janitorial staff. Take a listen. Reporting from New Westminster, BC, this is Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. Gathered outside the TransLink corporate office in New Westminster, SkyTrain janitorial staff employed by Dextera Group, a company contracted by TransLink, rallied to make known the major issues they have with their current working conditions and employer.
We kept raising these issues because they were real. We asked for help. We asked for to be heard. And for months, I felt like nobody wanted to listen. Now WorkSafe BC has investigated documented violations. The concerns workers were raised raisings weren't exaggerated. We weren't making them up. We were telling the truth.
The janitorial workers with TransLink SkyTrain system are also members of the Service Employees International Union Local 2, and for months have been reporting instances of workplace mistreatment, particularly regarding worker health and safety. These allegations were recently corroborated by WorkSafe BC inspections, and so SkyTrain janitorial workers are calling on TransLink CEO Kevin Quinn to hold Dexterra Group accountable. CJSF attended the rally where those in attendance crossed the street towards the TransLink office building, hoping to hear from Kevin Quinn directly. It was unclear whether he was in the office, but building security prohibited anyone from entering the building, and no communication with TransLink staff or Kevin Quinn was had at the time. After the rally, we spoke with Dallas Van Steinberg, a union rep with SEIU Local 2, about some of the specifics of the workers' grievances and what had led up to this rally outside of the TransLink corporate office.
Well, we're gathered out here after a seven-month fight. The workers have brought up issues since February 1st when a new contractor came in on the SkyTrain for the cleaners called Dexterra. Now, Dexterra came in with no supplies, with very horrible management team that threatened our workers with intimidation, tried to decertify the union by withholding pay, engaged in conversations and threatening behavior when they asked for PPE or anything to keep them safe while doing their job. They asked them to clean the yellow line while the SkyTrain was running, and when they were trying to refuse, they told them they would get their visas pulled and sent back home. So we kept knocking on WCB's doors. We kept knocking on Kevin's door, BCRTC, and they told us, no, they're keeping every safety provision where it needs to be. There's no issue. We've audited them. There's no problem. We're not meeting with you. This is a problem not for us, but between you and your actual employer, which is Dexterra.
What are the next steps in the work that you're doing now to fight against this?
Well, the one thing that comes out of this strife is always activists. Our workers are great workers, but they now have the skill, the ability, understanding, they know how to do this fight. We're never going away. Until the final product comes where these workers are made whole and safety is kept in line, and that when bidding on a contract just isn't about the dollar amount, it's about how that contract will play out and how those workers will be supported and cared for, we're not done. We will be around forever.
Once again, that was Dallas Van Steinberg, a union rep with SEIU Local 2, speaking on behalf of the janitorial workers rallying against their working conditions with Dexterra Group and calling on TransLink CEO Kevin Quinn to hold the company accountable. This has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. You're listening to Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. Coming up next, we have a piece from our friends at CHLY in Nanaimo, BC.
This is a CHLY News Update. After outcry from the community and advocacy work from the city of Nanaimo, the government of BC has announced that they'll be changing plans for an upcoming housing project. On Thursday, September 3rd, local MLA and Minister of Social Development and Poverty Reduction, Sheila Malcolmson, joined the Mayor of Nanaimo, Leonard Krogh, to announce that a soon-to-be-built supportive housing project will operate as a recovery-oriented housing site. The planned 50-unit supportive housing building at 250 Bryden Street, previously 250 Terminal Avenue, is planned to replace the current temporary housing at Newcastle Place. Minister Malcolmson says, seeing how much low-barrier housing is already available in Nanaimo, she and the government knew they need more recovery-oriented housing.
So this housing will support people in recovery from substance use, people who've been at risk of homelessness or experienced homelessness and need additional support to stay housed, and to people who want to reduce their exposure to drugs and alcohol.
She says this substance-free housing model will expand the types of housing people can access throughout the city.
By expanding the range of housing options available in Nanaimo, our government is helping to ensure more people can find the support and stability that they need to move forward with their lives.
Malcolmson says she hopes the new building will help fill in the gaps for people experiencing homelessness on their journey to substance use recovery.
We're counting enormously on people who are in active addiction and want to get out of it, for them to be able to get the help that they need. And the model is kind of like the cancer care system. Once you're diagnosed, you get navigated through the system, and it hasn't been that way for the mental health and addiction system.
She says when the building at 250 Bryan Street opens, it'll be for people who are on a recovery journey or are leaving homelessness and want to be in an environment where there is no active substance use. The site is currently home to a temporary housing facility operated by Island Crisis Care Society. Malcolmson says when the new facility is built, the government will make sure people living at the current site will remain housed, even if they're not currently fit for recovery-oriented housing.
Our commitment as a government is that no one will become homeless as a result of that transition.
She says the operator for the new building has yet to be decided, but it's something the government is currently working on. This announcement comes after months of advocacy work from Nanaimo City Council to bring more substance-free housing to Nanaimo. This work included a special governance and priorities meeting in June of this year, where council heard from many speakers about the need for recovery-oriented housing in Nanaimo. Several speakers expressed a desire to see 250 Bryan Street be recovery-oriented. At the end of the meeting, council voted to have the mayor write a letter to the Ministry of Housing to again request that the new supportive housing at 250 Bryan Street be composed of dry, supportive units. At the announcement on Thursday, Mayor Krogh said that following the letter, the province decided to reconsider previous plans to make the site a low-barrier facility and instead have the housing be recovery-oriented.
The people who will be able to live in this new facility will have such a much better opportunity to engage in a fruitful, productive, and happy life. We all want to live in peace and security and happiness.
Following the announcement, CJY heard from Karen Kowicka, president of the Newcastle Community Association, about this change of plans for the supportive housing development.
I think that drug traffickers just got an eviction notice.
Kowicka says the community association has been advocating for housing on the site to be substance-free since the opening of Newcastle Place in 2018.
The announcement just happened, and I'm really encouraged. I'm also encouraged that we've been invited to be part of the discussions that about how the program will go out and the site itself.
She says this type of housing is needed in Nanaimo.
And we've always said that supports are necessary for people that are coming out of substance use or want supports without being in an environment where substances are used.
The 50-unit recovery-oriented housing project at 250 Bryan Street is expected to break ground next year. For CTY News in Nanaimo, this is Laura McKenzie.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you. You can find more news updates, interviews, and stories from our nonprofit newsroom, as well as our news and current affairs podcast, Midcoast Morning, at chly.ca/news.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. The Many Voices project at the Burnaby Village Museum is working towards including voices and perspectives that haven't had the opportunity to be a part of the city's historical record. Originally starting 4 years ago, the Burnaby Village Museum has recently put a call out for more participants to share their experiences living in Burnaby through oral history interviews as part of this project. Eventually, these interviews will become a part of the city's digital historic archive. To learn more about the project, how Burnaby residents can participate, and why it began in the first place, we reached out to Kay Petrusa, assistant curator at the Burnaby Village Museum. Please take a listen to our conversation.
I think one of the main jobs or roles of any museum is to collect information, stories, artifacts, and preserve those things and share those things, make them accessible. So The Many Voices Project is one way that we do that. We use the term oral history. It's kind of an academic term. But the idea being it's interviews with people who want to share their stories. And it's a really great way to broaden our collection. So we treat these interviews like we would an artifact, like a photograph. They are part of the museum's collection. And they really serve to diversify what we have in our collection. You know, the museum has been around for more than 50 years now. So the way we've collected, the people who've been involved with collecting has really evolved in 50 years. So this is an opportunity to reach groups of people that have not previously contributed to the museum at all, or to maybe a smaller degree. It's accessible to people who may not have a physical item that, you know, is deeply imbued with Burnaby history. I mean, we accept and collect things from all walks of Burnaby time. You know, it's not just old stuff. It's these interviews are examples of new contemporary stories that are relevant for Burnaby's history, for Burnaby's present, for the future. Another reason I really like doing this project is because I often do think into the future. So, you know, for example, we have, I would say, a really sizable collection right now of oral histories. And I love thinking of future curators, researchers, designers who will be able to draw on this really rich collection of like an intensively textured experience of what Burnaby's like right now. And another great thing about it is that people share their contributions, their stories in their own words. So we do contribute, when we have the interview recorded, that audio is available. We also provide a transcript, but having that audio file is just it's very personal. It's in someone's own words, so it's sort of a unique way of capturing history, a rich way to do it.
What was the outreach process like? Like, how do you get people to know that this is an option, this is something that they can contribute to?
Mm-hmm. Lots of ways. We've done, so yeah, I'm proud to say that the project is in its fourth year. And, you know, formally in its fourth year, but the museum has been doing outreach in this way for at least 10. So it sort of started with, at least initially, it started with a group of people that showed an interest in working with the museum, a community such as, well, the Chinese Canadian community came first. There's just, because there was an advisory at the time, an advisory committee, I should say. So a group, a close-knit group of people who had been here a long time and were just